Good morning. It's Friday, August 15th, and all eyes are on Pune. Many residents would also like those eyes to focus on something other than today's makeup election. We'll get a few perspectives on some longer-term issues, those invasive albizia trees, and why a community group is hot over geothermal operations during the tropical storm. And yes, we'll talk about the election, too. From HBR2, it's The Conversation.
And today we'll also go to the movies. A film from last year's Maui Film Festival gets another showing to make a point. We'll talk with Maui Youth and Family Services about the real-life short-term 12. And production of a new film is completed in Hawaii. It premieres next month. We'll get a status report on the young adult book soon to come to your screen, Under the Blood Red Sun.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
The conversation starts right after this news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vanderkirk. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
More issues from the Big Island today.
And ongoing issues, particularly as we look at one that we kind of knew about before, the issue with those albizia trees. There are no albizia trees on Molokai, and Hawaii Island would like to take a lesson. The rapidly spreading invasives with shallow root systems make them unstable, as Tropical Storm Isel brought home. But beyond the periodic threat, the ongoing injury to native watersheds by displacing diverse multi-layered forests is what conservationists have talked about for years. And although they say that eradication on the Big Island isn't feasible, containment of albizia is. Springer Kay is the manager of the Big Island Invasive Species Committee. She stopped by our studio during her trip to Oahu earlier this month, and I asked her if the situation in Puna just made her case a little easier to make.
Well, I think after this week, nobody has any doubt in their mind. You know, for years, the Big Island Invasive Species Committee has been trying to raise awareness about the dangers this tree poses. But even we really had no idea how devastating this was going to be when it actually happened.
At this point where we have those trees being removed and it may be perhaps a little easier for you to make the case that we should remove more of these trees from where they are, shouldn't we concentrate first on areas which could be hard hit if one of those trees fell on a home, on a hospital, in a place where it would really impede human necessity?
Absolutely. You know, even though right now everyone can take a look at this and say, okay, this is a problem that has to be managed, it's also very overwhelming. And when you realize the Puna district is really the size of Oahu, you could pick Oahu up and set it down nicely in Puna. So it's a very large-scale problem. So it's a matter of prioritizing what we can do and how. Exactly what you're saying, we look at mapping where the critical infrastructure is, where the homes, highways, and power lines are that are impacted by albizia. And we have staff working on that right now. And then going through those areas and piece by piece taking the albizia down. This is after the initial recovery effort, making sure that this never happens again. It's slow and it's costly to do that hazard albizia removal. We're looking at about $200,000 a mile to remove large trees along power lines. But once you move outside that immediate 100-foot area within the sides of the roads, it becomes very fast, cheap, and easy to control albizia.
Are you talking about eradicating it or just putting it into, as you call it, you know, controlling it?
Right. That's a really good question. So to be perfectly clear, we cannot eradicate albizia from the state of Hawaii, but we certainly don't have to live with it looming over our homes and our highways.
When you talk about $200,000 per mile, how many miles are you talking about?
Well, we're working on answering that question right now. We had mapped out what we thought might be an appropriate emergency corridor of 30 miles of road between Lower Puna and the Hilo Hospital. And in that 30 miles, there were really only 5 miles that were heavily impacted by Albizia. So that area never really got taken care of until this storm hit, but it was relatively fast to clean it up. We're finding, though, that the worst problem are in these private subdivisions, where most of the roads are small county or privately owned roads that get very little maintenance and therefore have the largest, densest population of Albizia.
Are there any creative financing ways of being able to make this happen as opposed to putting in real dollars, offering people any sort of, a rebate or something that you would give them or something off their taxes if they're able to remove Albizia?
Well, we've been working with literally all the stakeholders we can think of throughout the state, and there are a number of creative ideas. We'd like to talk to the insurance commissioner about what sort of incentive packages could be put together where perhaps homeowners could get a break on their homeowners insurance if they show that they've taken care of an Albizia threat. There are other issues with how things like highways are financed. 80% of the money that goes into building a state highway comes from the federal highways programs. Now, that money should be tied to invasive species maintenance. You should not be able to create a situation where invasive species like Albizia are able to thrive and take over without controlling it.
Failure waiting to happen.
Right. So it's money that needs to be built in right from the beginning to stop it from happening in the future.
For a lot of us who are living on Oahu and may not have issues with Albizia and may only know that, well, if you go up into Manoa, you can see some. Mm-hmm. Is it a tougher case to make because we are talking about doing this on the Big Island?
Well, let me tell you, we really need the Oahu legislators behind this effort. Obviously, we only have 9 House representatives on the Big Island. I think we have 4 senators. We're dwarfed by the power that comes out of Honolulu. I can tell you there's Albizia in Wahiawa. It's in Pearl City. It's on the Pali Highway growing out of the top of one of the Pali tunnels right now. Now, those trees are never going to get to 150 feet high because they're going to fall over first on that steep lava rock slope. But this isn't a Oahu problem. It is a Maui problem. It is a Kauai problem. And we really need a statewide effort behind this.
At this point, when the efforts on the Big Island are directed toward cleaning up what's already fallen and being able to make sure that people have some return to normalcy, after that period wanes a bit and this argument starts to grow a little cooler from a legislative session that's still, 6 months away, how are you going to keep up the pressure and the efforts to make sure that this doesn't get lost and all the other really wonderful things that people are trying to talk about and prep for a session 2015?
Right. There are so many priorities, but the people of Puna are very organized politically. We know how to make some noise, and I don't think people are going to let this one go. As the cleanup effort progresses, I am certain that it will be declared a disaster area. Anyone who's been to the area is quite convinced of that, and we're hoping that federal funding will become available. And that money can fund work efforts. The Big Island is also one of the most economically depressed areas of the state, particularly the Puna District, and we need jobs. And controlling Albizia in a proactive way is a skilled job, but it's something that a lot of people can do for a relatively small amount of money and get some work and get some good experience while taking care of their communities.
Are there any conversations started with FEMA?
There's conversations started with our U.S. delegation, talking to our senators about how that money can be best put to work if it can be made available.
So you started the process, and it's going to be rather long and circuitous.
We're trying to get a commitment from every one of our senators and representatives to make this a priority, to not let this one go.
How about from the volunteer sector? Are there organizations that have offered to come in and help with this?
Well, people talk about volunteerism a lot, and it may be a Oahu, Big Island cultural difference where so many of the folks on the Big Island are working in agriculture. They're working in outdoor heavy labor jobs. And when they have a free Saturday, the first thing on their agenda may not be to come out and do heavy work outdoors. They've been doing it all week. So it's maybe a little different from if you work, say, in an office building in Honolulu, where that sounds like a lot of fun to do on a Saturday. So what we found is that we need people to be paid for doing good work and for helping their community and maintaining the sides of highways, maintaining utility lines, and maintaining common space. That's all work that should be paid labor.
As opposed to going to an external group that might parachute in to do a little bit and then parachute back out again.
Right, exactly.
All right, well, we will watch and see what happens with this go-round and how you continue to make some noise about removing albizia trees, and also understanding for all of us that invasives do have very unintended consequences because these things, as you mentioned earlier, were originally brought in. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Springer Kay is the manager of the Big Island Invasive Species Committee and has been battling invasive species in Hawaii since 1996. The Big Island Invasive Species Committee is one of five island-based partnerships working to address the most harmful invasive species threats to the state's environment, economy, and way of life. You can find a link to the Big Island Invasive Species Committee on our website, hpr2.org.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR 2. It's 8:14. Later in the show, life in Hawaii in the days after Pearl Harbor, evoked in a new movie. But first, your quiz.
We just talked about the invasive albizia trees, but for today's backyard quiz, we're focusing on another invasive known scientifically as Darna palavita. In September of 2001, this type of stinging caterpillar was first discovered near Hilo, a long way from its common home in Southeast Asia, where it feeds on coconut, palms, and grasses. According to Hawaii's DLNR, the caterpillar has attacked more than 35 different plants in the Hilo area, including gardenia, mamaki, and wiliwili, and why they're hoping to control, if not completely eradicate, these little invaders. If you ever see one, though, be mindful. The spines covering them will cause a burning when they touch human skin. So, can you tell us the common name for Darna palavita? Call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know. Otherwise, we'll be back with the answer a little later in the hour.
Aloha, I'm Yukalana Luli from Kailua, Oahu. You're tuned to HPR 2, Hawaii Public Radio. Learn more about what you hear on the show at facebook.com/HIConversation.
Few stories have dramatized the human side of the Second World War in Hawaii as well as Graham Salisbury's novel, Under the Blood Red Sun. It captures the moment when innocence was lost forever in Hawaii, the morning of the Pearl Harbor attack. The years that followed strained families and friendships, tested the bonds that had held society together in the islands, and the movie version of that popular book has been a long time coming. It's very much a made in Hawaii project, but it's here. And Tim Savage, the director, is with us this morning. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Historical fiction has a really important place in the sense that it takes us in through important events through the eyes of a human being. In this case, a young boy, yeah?
That's right. And we thought it was really important that our young people would get to see the depiction of Pearl Harbor and the start of World War II and the internment camps and what different cultures went through here in Hawaii in a fiction, in a dramatic piece through a young boy's eyes. Because I think they'll remember that. It'll have more of an impact on them. It'll be more of an experience that they won't forget in the future.
One of the really effective things, I think, is that the story is in the eyes of a boy who's, 13? He's just coming into his young manhood. So it's a time of life when you're starting to figure a lot out.
It is. If you've been around 13-year-olds, there's still this wonderful naivete about them. They're still trusting and loving and friendly. And then, you know, they begin to change at 14 and 15, and they become different people. They become adults at that point. So this age is really seminal, and it's really critical to the story that we're telling, because it is a coming of age, and he's facing things that adults would have to face, but through a child's eyes.
And he's facing his own identity as a Japanese American with Japanese parents and ties of loyalty to the culture and to the country.
That's right. So his family is from Japan. His mother and father are from Japan, and they hold very dear to things like honor and respect. And yet he's part of the American community here. He goes to Roosevelt, and his friends are locals, and they're Haoles. His best friend is a newly planted Haole from the mainland. And so he has all of these different influences in his life, and he's trying to remain true as much as he can to each of them.
And you know what's interesting, Tim, is that although these are conflicting influences, they're all legitimate.
Oh, yeah. Well, especially growing up here in Hawaii, we're always part of kind of a multicultural family.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that's true for anywhere you are in the world. But we all know that, you know, we may be one way at home with our parents who were raised a certain way, and we're another, you know, we're slightly different at school with our buddies or at work. And so we're part of this multicultural society. And so I think that's something that we all understand.
And everybody wants to be true to who he is at the same time as we want to assimilate. And they're in contradiction.
And that's a big part of this story. And so you get to know Tomi, and you get to know his best friend, Billy, who is Caucasian from the mainland. And he has a group of buddies that he's, you know, they play baseball with and they go to school with, and they're just normal kids, you know, from the neighborhood growing up here in Hawaii with their different cultural backgrounds. So there's a lot of humor that comes out of that, obviously. There's a lot of drama that comes out of that. But it's really the kind of seminal to the story of Under the Blood Red Sun, all of these different cultures and racial tolerance and the experience that happened when we weren't tolerant at one point in our history.
Because in this young man's family, there is still a serious allegiance to Japanese culture.
Again, the family has come to Hawaii from Japan, and they come with a mother, father, and a grandfather. So each of them trying to assimilate to a certain extent. But as we all know, even in our own families, so the grandfather is very resolute in his devotion to Japan. And he'll be out, you know, in the yard waving the Japanese flag, singing a Japanese song.
Yeah. There's a great moment when the kid says, don't do that.
Don't do that.
Yeah.
Because our Haole landlords are watching. They see this, and they know that there's a problem. They follow the news, and Japan is not our friend right now. There are some serious things going on, and this could bring us big danger. And of course, Grandpa doesn't understand that, and that causes tension outside of the family, for the family, and within the family, as Tomi's trying his best to fit in.
And you know, having that character waving the Japanese flag also kind of shows one of the ironies of the Second World War for the Japanese American population, in the sense that the Japanese Empire went to war based on the ancient cultural principles. It was an honorable enterprise. The code of Bushido prevailed, and the grandfather would have to still have a strong allegiance to that, and yet that's now the enemy.
Yeah, it's really interesting, because he would be kind of the samurai of this film, you know, standing up for what's right and doing what he feels is right. And this code of honor, which was ironclad, in Japan and in Japanese culture, but all of a sudden becomes this source of huge shame.
Yeah,
so
just over
it's,
like that.
It's not just Tomie who is experiencing this change and going through all of this, but all of the characters are trying to find their way through a whole new way of doing life because everything they knew has now changed.
And, you know, and that reversal comes so abruptly on a quiet Sunday morning.
Sunday morning, 7:40 a.m., most people still just kind of, you know, getting out of bed, and the Japanese fighter planes, the Zeros, come flying in, and nobody even knew what they were doing, why they were there, until they heard the bombs and saw the devastation in Pearl Harbor.
You know, there used to be a lot of people in Hawaii who had memories of that moment and even told stories of making eye contact with a young Japanese
man
in a plane.
Yeah, it's really interesting that we've shown a part of the film at a book and music festival, and I would say that the people who right now are the most interested in it are older. You know, we kind of thought that, well, it's a family film, and it's required reading in a lot of
young
middle schools.
Novel,
so that was one of our target audiences, but it's the older population that seems very, very interested in this, and they're the ones stopping me daily saying, now when again is it premiering, and how can I see it? Because I think they feel very, very tied to this story.
Well, let's wrap it up by saying when it is premiering, Tim.
We're going to be showing this at the Pacific Aviation Museum on September 14th, so we're a little under a month away. And then there are a couple of other special premieres, one at the Pearl Harbor Memorial, and then one at the Honolulu Academy of Arts. So we have several very special events coming up, and we're excited to unveil this.
It's a very exciting thing. I really thank you for coming in, Tim.
Thank you so much for having me.
I really
appreciate it.
Tim Savage is the director of the new movie Under the Blood Red Sun, which premieres next month, and we'll have details at hpr2.org.
Sandy Sukiyama and girlfriends Rachel Gonzalez, Rhea Davis, and Allison Maldonado just want to have fun. It's a tribute to lady songwriters in the Atherton on August 23rd. They'll be singing Aretha Franklin, Laura Nyro, Carly Simon, and more. Saturday, August 23rd at 7:30. Tickets at hprtickets.org or 955-8821 during business hours.
Hawaii Public Radio salutes its dedicated station members. The station's business model is an unlikely one, and your personal commitment is proof positive it's one that works. We gratefully acknowledge Joanne Sark of Honolulu, Gwen Pacheco of Kailua Kona, and Michael Murata of Honolulu for your recent gifts. We're proud to count all of you among HPR's growing family of members, and now you can join the people who are making a difference every day. Just go to hpr2.org and click on the support link.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Central Pacific Bank, offering private banking, trust administration, and financial management services to help individuals and families reach their financial goals. Learn more at centralpacificbank.com.
Yesterday, the Hanabusa camp and the sentiment of many in the Puna area were thwarted, despite acknowledging that common sense might dictate otherwise. The Hilo judge allowed the makeup election in Puna to go forward today. It seemed to boil down to the need for finality over fairness, although some might have other F words to describe it. Civil Beats Chad Blair has today's reality check. Good morning, Chad.
You meant fairness, right?
Fairness. Finality over fairness. Getting the election over and done in a timely way, whereas the other side is saying, but it's not fair. And having all of that come down to what the judge decided yesterday left a lot of people feeling a little bit, left out.
In particular, the Hanabusa camp, they released a statement saying they were very disappointed with the judge's decision. They really feel that the folks of Puna are not really being... that the judge pretty much ignored their needs, this fundamental right to vote, given all the problems, the power out, the lack of notification perhaps about the election. But Greg Nakamura, the circuit court judge, said, look, I just don't have the legal justification here, while sympathetic. But he also suggested that there may be an inroad should Colleen Hanabusa want to appeal this thing, and we'll see what happens after the vote comes in tonight. There might be a very good rationale for the Supreme Court to take this up if Hanabusa decides to go forward.
Earlier this week, we talked to Senator Russell Ruderman. He said that he's been talking about the same issue since last Saturday, although he was not at all in league with the Hanabusa camp, but just trying to make people aware of what was going on in his district, and that seemed to fall in many ways on deaf ears. That seems in some cases to have been mitigated by what we heard yesterday, the common sense kind of argument. But the bottom line was there was no real legal standing to be able to impede the election today.
Right. And I should say Ruderman has endorsed Schatz, has actually sent out a letter this week urging folks in Puna, his district, to vote for the senator for a number of reasons, particularly his environmental views. So,
but particularly interesting, though, but even with that, particularly interesting that he would still say that it was very important that whoever wanted to be able to vote should vote.
Have that fundamental right, exactly, rather than be disenfranchised. So on a bright side, on some good news, Nick Gruby and P.F. Bentley are actually there at the elementary school, the single precinct that was reopened today. It opened at 7. We have a couple of pics up on our Twitter site of people standing in line to vote. What a heartwarming thing. Some good news. Of course, we don't know what the results are going to be, but we should have them not too long after 6 p.m. tonight, depending on how long it takes to count the absentee votes, the ballots that are dropped off.
And, of course, to say that this may or may not be the end of it, as we talked about a little bit earlier.
I mean, imagine if Hanabusa wins. Does she still sue?
Well, I mean, and the issue, too, that if, as people were talking about, that, you know, Schatz had more of an edge on the Big Island, then, you know, for him to keep quiet and just be helpful and do what he was doing was, his tact. And that even if, as you mentioned, Russell Ruderman was in his camp, the fact that he was pointing toward having a possible delay of the election has everybody looking at it from lots of different angles, trying to make sure that the voting rights of the area are protected.
Absolutely. And we'll be following this tonight, reporting on the results of the election as they come in this evening. It should be pretty quick, given that we're talking less than 8,000, about 8,200 people.
So, hey, maybe by 6:30 or 7. Just kidding.
On a Friday evening, Pauhana.
Pauhana watching the election. That's the thing to do, at least tonight. Thanks so much, Chad. Talk to you on Monday. Have a good weekend.
Thanks. Oh, thanks, Beth Ann. Bye-bye.
Chad Blair is a political reporter for CivilBeat.com.
Good morning. I'm Chris Vandercook, and it's 8:31. You're tuned to The Conversation on statewide, member-supported HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. If you want to be in touch, there are plenty of options. Post your comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation. Tweet us at HI Conversation or at BKOZHPR. And you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Stay tuned for a view from the front lines of the struggle to keep families together on Maui.
And in local news, at least on a Friday, we always look toward Monday and the rest of the week and what we'll see happening. It seems Bill Dorman, HPR's news director, would agree that it's going to be all Puna all the time for a little bit.
Well, it's tough to tell. You know, usually we come in with sort of a list of things of, well, this reporter's going to be looking at that, this reporter's going to be looking at that. To be honest, right now, I don't really have that much of a clue because things are so fluid right now, just in the news situation in terms of, yes, Pune recovery, the election itself. I mean, of course, a week ago we were talking about the elections on Saturday, and now we'll wrap up what happens with today's voting. And by the way, tonight on HPR1, we'll be keeping you posted on the results of that. We may know something a little bit after 7:30 or, you know, up to 8 o'clock. It depends on how long it takes to drive the drive some of the results up to Hilo and then transport them to get them over to Honolulu. Although this is all, it's all electronic ballots, no paper ballots to scan this time around. But we will see. And then within all of this, Wayne Yoshioka's over in Pune. He's down there tomorrow, going to be checking in on recovery efforts as well. So we'll have something from him on that the early part of next week.
Some are concerned that with all of the focus that we've had on Pune since last week, that somehow these larger issues that have been talked about for a while, we talked earlier this morning about the albizia trees, certainly those that we'll talk with later on in the hour with Harry Kim about geothermal, that some of these issues are not necessarily going to get the attention that they need because more is going to Pune for perhaps reasons that even Pune residents don't want, just that, oh, gee, they made some real difference this time as opposed to what difference they'd like the rest of the state to be able to make for them.
Well, it's interesting. The idea that the story in Pune is over after they vote is certainly not true. And the way that the state responds, federal agencies respond, I mean, everything through, you know, the aid that filters through FEMA goes down through a group like the Small Business Administration. We're going to have to see how those recovery efforts go, and that's going to be a continuing story. And that's part of why I say our news plans are fluid, because we want to capture part of that as we go along as well. The story in Pune definitely does not end with the election.
And that's the bottom line. We're going to leave it right there. Thanks very much, Bill. Have a good weekend.
You bet.
We'll catch up with you next week. Bill Dorman is the news director for Hawaii Public Radio.
Good morning. I'm Byron Lai from Tiki Tabu. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
In the middle of storm cleanup, why would a group long opposed to geothermal power gather for a meeting? Pono Pono Alliance says their meeting on Tuesday was a direct result of what happened just as a tropical storm Isel was approaching Hawaii Island. Pune Geothermal Power was still operating and released fluid and vented hydrogen sulfide into the air. The group says that seems to make the point that either PGV was incompetent or indifferent. Former Big Island Mayor Harry Kim is a Pune Pono Alliance member, and he joins us now by phone. Good morning.
Good morning to you, and I'd like to ask a favor. Before we go on the geothermal issue, I would like to spend just a minute or two on the election issue.
Sure.
Because I think we're missing a point that is very, very critical to many of your listeners in regards to has not been publicized in any way or form regarding the election.
All right, Harry, go ahead.
First of all, all of the information in regards to the Hanabusa, Ms. Hanabusa, in regards to trying to get at least a delay of the voting until some other time, did not, in any of the coverage, I think with great disappointment to all of the residents, regardless of the outcome of what the court allowed. Let's say they did allow the election to be delayed. It did not address that regardless, there are many, many people. I do not have the number. I can tell you all of the area of what we call the hardest hit by the hurricane, such as Kapoho, such as Wawa, parts of Leilani, Kalapana, you know, those areas would not have been able to vote because they were not involved in a state elections office action on when to have it or the suit itself. What I'm talking about is that the elections office made a determination that they will allow voting to be held today to those areas that the voting the polls were closed down. And those were the two areas of Paradise Park and Keonopoko area. Pahoa High School, which is the center of the Puna area of Pahoa Town, was left open. However, that Pahoa voting poll, booth rather, was a voting place for all of the areas hardest hit by the hurricanes, which includes Wawa, Pohiki, Kapoho Beach, Las Vacation, Kalapana area, where many hundreds of people reside. And because they were totally shut down in electrical power, ingress, egress, water, et cetera, voting was not even possible for them on the Saturday it was held. I did not understand.
Harry, I would like to tell you that actually we did talk about that, and Senator Ruderman talked about that and looked at the greater issue of that it wasn't just for the polling places that themselves or that were damaged by the storm, but for those people who might have been areas that were hardest hit where polling places for whatever reason were open, but these people couldn't get out of their driveways.
They couldn't. Life at that point, I know it's very difficult to understand the situation, but it was a very, very difficult situation. And still, I just talked to a resident this morning to see where he could get the certain size of generator so he could begin, assisting in regards to repair. Life is still very difficult in regards to running water because you have no power, and in regards to obviously power that affects everything else. But if you was covered, then I apologize for that. I missed it. I did talk to elected officials about this. That it is, I think, very difficult for people to understand that here you are being devastated by nature, and now being ignored by the government process of voting.
And for a lot of people, the last thing that might have been on their minds at that point in time would be to get out and vote when they can't get out of their driveways.
Oh, I guarantee you, you're right in the sense that voting is the last thing on people's mind when you're just talking about survival.
Okay, so let's talk now a little bit about the venting that happened just as Issel was getting to Hawaii Island, and why you say that, why was the plant even operating like this, knowing that a storm was barreling down?
Well, we had a meeting last night, as you know. The only correction I've got, I'm not a member of Puna Pono in regards to active member or signed member. However, I do attend their meetings on invitations like I did last night. This is the one community group that is very organized representing the Puna area. That was a very heavy question. We have some very knowledgeable people within the community that asked the question, why was the plant allowed to continue when you were in a hurricane warning status? Records will show that the whole area was in a whole hurricane warning status at least 24 hours prior to impact. And when you have a situation like this where there's a potential risk of impact in regards to the plant, it continued. It continued without any change in operations. We were told last night that they did cut down the amount of power generated, and I guarantee you the answers did not satisfy those people there, because plain and simple, this is not to be negative or any other way, plain and simple, according to Puna Geothermal Venture, decision was made by the company and Hawaii Electric Light Company, according to PGV, that operations will continue. They even indicated that they were not at full staff as far as the amount of staff that are assigned to that plant because of the numbers, because that question was asked also. So you can imagine being a resident, you're in hurricane warning status, you have a plant there of this situation where potential hazard and risk is a factor when there is a disruption, and the wind caused the disruption, and therefore a release of abated and unabated hydrogen sulfide to the public area. And naturally, you know, the discontent and concern of people, coupled with the fact that the guys are completely cut off, and I mean completely, it's very hard, I think, for many of you listening to visualize, but we're talking about the Albizia's trees, by the way, which the state planted in the 50s for an experimental basis on providing trees for the area. Albizia trees that you know, have been causing problems for years and years because of a slight wind or rain or whatever. And here you have a storm coming up, and the people in authority decide to continue operations as normal. And that's mind-boggling to people. And consequently, the result of that was a release of hydrogen sulfide that was abated and unabated.
And real insult to injury to all of the people there who were coping with a whole lot. Your point is that so many of these issues wrap into each other and can't just be looked at singly, although certainly the issue of geothermal power has been ongoing, as has the issue with the Albizia trees. At this point, we're going to have to leave it just in the interest of time, but we hope we can check back with you. And thanks very much for being able to talk to us about everything, including the election today. Thank you so much.
I do thank you for your coverage. People down there, for a good part, many of them, your coverage in what the quote-unquote outside world was basically the only coverage available for a while. So thank you for that.
Thank you so much. Harry Kim is a former mayor of Hawaii County and served from 2000 to 2008. The Puna Pono Alliance letter is posted on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation.
Good morning. I'm Annie Kamiya from Mango Season. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
If our earlier mention of Albizia trees didn't get you concerned about invasive species, today's quiz gave you a little more to consider. In September of 2001, a type of stinging caterpillar known as Darna palevita was first discovered in Hawaii in a nursery near Hilo. The species is from Southeast Asia and is known to feed on coconut, palms, and grasses. And according to the Hawaii DLNR, it attacks more than 35 different plants in the Hilo area, including banana, mondo grass, coffee, and wili wili. If you ever see one in the wild, be wary and don't touch. The spines covering them can cause a nasty burning sensation. For our backyard quiz today, we asked you for the common name for Darna palevita, and with those stinging spines, you might have guessed most people refer to it as the nettle caterpillar. It's 8:48, and that's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org. We all can be grateful that there are people among us who take on the seemingly thankless jobs working with people who are, in one way or another, at risk. The people who give their time to Maui Youth and Family Services are dedicated to the notion that all of us deserve a chance to live up to our full potential, even if serious behavioral issues stand in the way. The work takes patience and dedication and is being honored tonight with a concert and the showing of a Maui-made documentary about a foster home facility for at-risk teens. Frances Duberstein is the development coordinator for Maui Youth and Family Services. She's on the line from Maui. Good morning, Frances.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Pretty good. You work with the kind of, about the 12 to 18 age group in large part?
Most of our youth are in the 12 to 18 age group, but we do have kids that are a little bit younger than that, maybe like 9 or 10, but predominantly, yes, that 12 to 18 age group.
What's important about reaching kids during those years of their lives?
Sure. Well, we take a two-way approach. We have prevention programs, first off, that are for middle schoolers, both in school and after school. And the goal with the prevention programs is to help them create friendships in a safe environment and learn about the dangers of drugs so that later when they are presented with these opportunities, they already have these strong friendships and they already have other interests that will hopefully lead them away from drugs or alcohol. But what we also do is kind of, it's called our intervention programs, and these are for kids that have been identified as having issues. You talked about behavioral before. It could be issues related to drugs or alcohol or mental health or just general coping issues. And so with those programs, we have actually substance abuse treatment outpatient for teenagers, as well as emergency shelters and therapeutic foster care. And we have a program called the Independent Living Program. And this is for youth who are aging out of foster care, helping them with finding a place to live, getting health care, developing and achieving academic and professional goals. So we really want to provide that base of support that a lot of kids who might have drug and alcohol issues usually don't have. They don't have a solid home family environment to lean back on, so we want to make sure that they do have some sort of support system.
Well, Francis, when you talk about the prevention programs, building networks of friendships, in a way, what you're doing is you're shoring them up for the future, in the sense that a lot of times drug and alcohol issues are to fill a gap of some kind. Is that?
Exactly.
That has been your observation.
Well, I think from talking with our clinical staff who works with the youth, that oftentimes the kids who are getting involved in these activities, they don't have a way. They're bored a lot of the times, and they don't know what to do to keep themselves entertained, and they might not have a very stable home environment. And so using the drugs or alcohol is an escape for them. It's something fun. And we just want to make sure they know that there's other ways that they can have fun. And even if they don't have that support system at home, there is a community out there that does care about them, cares about what happens to them. And I think that if they know that, they're less likely to engage in the unhealthy activities.
It really helps to understand that people go toward drugs or substance abuse for a reason, yeah?
Absolutely, yes. That's Maui Youth and Family Services is a part of an umbrella agency with two other organizations, Aloha House and Malama Family Recovery Center. And those agencies focus on adults. And absolutely, there is always some reason linked to drug or alcohol use. And so with all three agencies, we want to try and figure out what those underlying issues are. Because then in the long term, if those issues reemerge, then the people we work with hopefully will better know how to deal with them without resorting to their old habits.
Because if the drugs are there in a person's life as a substitute for something,
mm-hmm.
if you give them the thing that they're substituting for, then they don't need it, right?
I think that that's pretty much how I don't work with the clients one-on-one, and I don't have a background in substance abuse counseling, but I think that from talking to former clients that I've talked to, a lot of them have said, you know, I gave up hope that life could be any different. I gave up hope of a future. So when you lose that hope, then if you're hurting yourself through drugs or alcohol, it doesn't matter because you don't think that life's going to get better anyway. So if we let them know that life can get better and they can feel better and they can have a support system around them, then it gives them a reason to not resort to the drugs or alcohol.
It's so many people find out the hard way that it's a blind alley. It's a shame, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, Francis, I appreciate the work you do, and I thank you for taking the time to talk with us this morning.
Sure. Well, thank you. And I just wanted to do a quick correction. Short Term 12 is not a documentary. It's actually a narrative feature.
Sorry, you're right.
Yeah, it's based on true life events, but it's not.
Yeah.
It's not a documentary. So it really takes a subject matter that's pretty difficult. The idea of homeless teens who have no place to go and turns into a very entertaining, funny, and dramatic film.
You're right. Thanks for that, Frances.
Certainly. Well, thank you.
Frances Duberstein is the development coordinator for Maui Youth and Family Services, hosting a concert by Steve Zawala and a showing of Short Term 12 tonight. You can find out more at hpr2.org.
Hawaii Public Radio congratulates Krista Tippett, creator and host of On Being, on receiving the 2013 National Humanities Medal. With this distinguished award, presented by President Obama, the White House acknowledged Tippett's achievements in, quote, thoughtfully delving into the mysteries of human existence. You can listen to On Being every Sunday at 10 a.m. here on HPR2. Congratulations, Krista Tippett, on this honor.
As you were just talking a moment ago about what a lot of us really need to understand about kids who may not feel that there could be a better tomorrow. That was a sentiment we heard last night when we talked on Town Square, when we were looking at the issue of depression, that it's not something that's an adult phenomenon. We really need to understand that kids keenly feel this too, and especially in that 15 to 24 age group.
It's that loss of hope that makes depression seem so terminal. And even when you're in the worst of a depressed state, if there's some hope somewhere, chances are you're going to be able to fight through it. But it's that hope is such a key word in all this discussion.
And sometimes we fob it off, but yeah. It's such an important thing to actually have some glimmer of something that might make your day a little better. Well, we had a caller last night who said that he used to buy a lottery ticket and say, well, I can't do something to myself or off myself because, well, I want to see how this is coming up. Any sort of little something that might make him drive forward. But in this case, with the screening of Short Term 12, a lot of good ways in which kids can be given some hope.
Yeah, that was an encouraging story, I thought.
That's going to do it for us for today. Coming next week, well, we're going to see how the Didi trial may go from here now that it's over. Will there be another one? Also, how campaign posturing begins to change. Lots to talk about next week.
And gentlemen callers, be advised, there's a casting call on Maui for the Glass Menagerie.
If you'd like to hear any of the show today or get other pieces of information, look on our website, hpr2.org.
Our executive producer is Beth Ann Kozlovich.
Lillian Song produces the program, and Taylor Rice is our production assistant.
The Backyard Quiz theme is written for us by John DeMello. I'm Chris Vander.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. See you Monday.